to recoup the cost. I mean, it seems that you go backwards and not to the end user if you're going to charge a fee.
But it's not a whole station. It's, you know, it's put together on a single station from all commercial opportunities.
That's right. So you share, you know, people who are putting programming on it.
Whatever. On the procedures that you go through in that bid process, and I've just heard that there are some problems about usable space or usable building space and things like that. Is that a statutory change that needs to be made in order to give you some flexibility? Maybe we could have the plans drawn up and then just put the plans out for bid rather than put the specs out and let someone else come in with however they want to configure it.
In terms of a lease buy, we're actually going to build a building and then lease it back?
Right. Or in terms of if we're going to go out with something like this where we would own our own building?
The quick answer is I don't know, but I'll sure take a look at it. I know that there have been a substantial number of problems with the lease purchase or the lease financing kind of situation. And I don't know specifically whether those problems were statutory, regulatory, or administrative, but we'll sure take a look at that. One of the things that we're finding is buying existing buildings is somewhat of uncharted territory. There's not a whole lot of historical experience with it, and we're being very cautious in how we proceed. You know, we don't want to end up writing a check for a building and find out it's full of asbestos, you know, or, you know, hasn't been properly taken care of in terms of the Americans with Disabilities Act requirements and those kinds of things, which obviously are a real concern to all of us right now. So, you know, I guess I err on the side of caution and want to make sure that we proceed with this very methodically. We've seen as a matter of fact, I heard somebody in my office say that we never have enough money to do it right, but we always have enough money to go back and fix it. And I want to be sure that the things that we do won't need fixing because we do it right the first time.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we have the commissioner here, and although it didn't come up on this list, I'd like us to talk a little bit about the changes that have taken place in information accounting and the Internal Services Fund. That is something that affects every department, and I think it would be good to have a few words on that while we have the whole committee here.
Thank you.
I'll just say one concern I've had is that we have not had a place in state government or a very effective way to scrutinize which of these information expenditures we're going to make and which ones we're not. And I think the change that we're going through offers opportunities to do that.
Just a quick response in the policy issue, and then I would like Kevin to address it, because I know Kevin has some real concerns about the fate of chargeback in the system. But we are actively pursuing reinstatement of the Telecommunications Information Council. I think it makes eminent sense that we have a group of people, a small core group of people who are interested and have knowledge on this, on these issues, to say, hey, this makes sense or this doesn't. What direction do we want to go to? What is the mix of mainframe versus LANs and WANs and all of the other things that we have to do? What is the information that we truly need in this state, not just because it looks like a nifty new toy? And that needs to be an ongoing dialogue. And it also needs to interface with a more technical level of review, which is the Project Review Committee. And we're also ginning that back up in our department. So I think we need to reinstitute the policy level discussions, interface that with the technical expertise that can come in and truly have some make sense on these projects. One of the things that we haven't, when we went back and looked at what went wrong, I think that there was, the process was flawed. And I say that because nobody likes to be told what to do. You know, you say, well, I've got funding for it. I got this great idea, and I've got this funding for it. And who are you to tell me that I can't do this, even if it is redundant, you know? That kind of territorialism and possessiveness in terms of ownership in these projects is something we just simply can't afford. And I don't know how, I can't tell you now, but I don't know how we're going to get around that kind of a barrier, but I think it's something that's going to be absolutely critical to the success of this is, you know, either we bump it up to the governor or we bump, you know, somebody's got to make the, you know, the thumbs up, thumbs down and say, doesn't matter how much funding you've found for it, it just simply doesn't make sense. But it's something that we're looking forward to working with the committee on. And may I ask, may I have Kevin talk a little bit about chargeback, because I think he has some real concerns about how this might be affected.
Well, I guess my major concern, and I'm sure members of the committee have seen in the individual subcommittees, transfers out of Department of Administration's budget into all the other departments who use the resource. And this is the culmination of a very long process that went in developing rates and working with all the agencies and coming up with a plan that everyone could buy into and that we thought we could make work. And now that the given reduction exercise, or given this reduction exercise, my concerns, I guess, are from that this would be an attractive place for people to look to cut would be on money coming into the budget. And whereas it's kind of putting us in a kind of a difficult position, because we're taking a leap of faith here and sending all this money out, and then what's going to happen in 93 when we start billing people for their usage. And in the practical matter, we're not going to be, you know, unplugging someone from the mainframe because they didn't pay their bill, but ultimately that's the last recourse that you'd have to do. And so just again trying to have a coordinated approach to this chargeback, and a lot of departments, a lot of people have put a lot of effort into it, and seeing it come through now is.
And ultimately, there will be savings associated with it, because it will provide an incentive for departments to be much more cost conscious of what it is that they're ordering up in terms of information services.
Maybe we could have one centralized fund allocated out to the departments where that was all they could use it for, and then have a drawdown on it so you could track it and something like that.
Well, I think for the first time we're going to be seeing more clearly than we have in the past what those expenditures are, and the agency can choose to buy from the Department of Administration, or if they can find a better, cheaper way to do it, they can buy from somebody else. But at some point, there's the overhead of the system that has to be maintained. There are also, in addition to just those core functions, a lot of new things that we see coming through. And I just want members to be aware that if you let it come through as an interagency receipt for these folks to do it, they're going to do it, presumably. And that's the reference to where does the buck stop and who gets to decide. In some respects, it stops right here. And we have to scrutinize mm-hmm. those expenditures and look for the duplicative things and the things that are not warranted. Like the AEA's proposals to build a new microwave system up the Kenai Peninsula, for example.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nancy, I'm really glad that you brought up the issue of the payroll. That has been something that has been bothering me a great deal. I could not believe when I heard how archaic the state's agency payroll systems were, that people still had to fill out paper timesheets. When it would appear to me you could easily have one person in each agency, you know, based on a 37.5-hour work week, every employee can be just plugged in as a regular number of hours, and then the adjustments made on the computer. I mean, we have very sophisticated computerized programs, and I'm just appalled that so much detailed time has been wasted doing it by hand and doing it by paper. And so I think that, you know, it's not a big item, but it certainly could save a lot of dollars and not cut any services to anybody.
Representative Kopanen?
Yes, actually, the costs of equipment and has been going down. The new chips are being invented all the time. In fact, well, I hesitate to buy anything because I don't know what's going to come next. But in the realm of, you mentioned earlier, archiving, it certainly seems that, you know, we've had problems before with microfiche, microfilm, putting things on disk because of magnetic degradation and all that. But with the new CD-ROM, you have as permanent a record, I think, as we're likely to get shortly, the laser scan read-only memory disk. Same, you can play rock and roll on them, or you can get data from them, but it takes up a lot less space. They put up the encyclopedia on a couple on them, so you should be able to keep most of your records. The records are necessary as a legal record. I know Department of Law came to the archive looking for something like 15 or 20-year-old records on the oil industry, which had everybody running around in circles for a while. But I think looking at the latest equipment and the prices of those things are much less, and if you can put a lot of a room full of stuff on a few CD-ROM discs, that would give you more office space for whatever you want to use it for. Maybe you can lease it to some other agency.
Lease it to somebody else. That would be a great idea.
Representative Brown.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out to people, in following up on a comment that Representative Bards made earlier, just looking at the pie chart, the top chart is the general funds of the department, and the dark area is the payments to the services and payments to the public, $125 million. And the part that services to state agencies is $45 million, and internal to the department is about $2 million. So if the reason I think that it appears that some of the things on this list, people are going, geez, isn't there anything else there we can cut, and how come we're not cutting bodies and so forth? And I think part of the reason is that this agency has, over time, really been squeezed to the point that it's going to be hard to find more reductions there. I think there are a few, but not a lot, and I just wanted to point that out to people, that most of the items, and especially the big-ticket items in this department, are in the area of the senior programs. That's really the major big-money piece of this agency.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, at some future time, I will have some recommendations where you can squeeze it a little more. And in that vein, Commissioner, in 1983, the Office of Public Advocacy was managed by the court system, and then it was later transferred over to your department. But when it was managed by the court system, and it's only been a few years since we moved it from the court system over to administration, but in 83, their budget was $1,741,300. Today, it's $6,488,100. I would like to have furnished to me, please, if you could, the reasons why this budget has grown so much in the last 10 years. That's just one particular example that is of interest to me. And as you must have gathered by now, I have a breakout of your budget over the last 10 years. So I'd be glad to sit down and share these figures with you, and perhaps you can give me some ideas as to where you think in your brief period with this agency that you might be able to start to at least cut back on some of the numbers of employees that are here.
Be happy to do that.
Representative McClain.
Yes, thank you. Commissioner Usera, the Department of Administration was working earlier on consolidating all state personnel functions. What is the status of that?
We are proceeding with that aggressively. Mm-hmm. All of the departments have undergone an audit. The key to this personnel consolidation is truly the consistency of the application of the personnel rules. And in order to assure that, we are developing the core piece of this project as a supervisor's manual that is some 30 chapters. Which will be the desk reference for people. We want to avoid part of the impetus in this is when you start looking at the grievances that come up, when we see that a lot of times it is out of sheer ignorance and not having clear direction that problems occur in the ranks. We can't afford that. And that manual is within two chapters of being complete. It has been a project that's been participated on by all of the personnel officers. There's been a team working on this. We are moving in the examination personnel from the various departments. I'd be happy to give you a full count of where we are. I don't have it off the top of my head, but we have started transferring in those people who receive and examine and score applications in the various departments, and we are proceeding down that road. I might mention that it's another area that we're working on, and as a matter of fact, one of the frustrations we talk about, one of the things that strike you as being odd when you look at the administration of some of these programs, we have state registers for jobs that have over 1,000 names on it. Those names, by rule, have to be on those registers for 2 years. These are jobs where those folks don't have a prayer of getting a job. You know, and I think that we do a real disservice by accepting someone's application, examining it, scoring it, putting their name on a register, that there is no hope that they are ever going to get a job. So we're looking at, as a matter of fact, we have OMB right now auditing that process, and one of the ideas that came out that we're going to pursue is when someone comes in, and if there is a full register, or if there are, you know, 100 names on the register, whatever the job happens to be that seems appropriate, they file a card that indicates their interest. So it would say, you Sarah/Nancy, these are the jobs that I'm interested in. It would be entered into a database, and should an opening come up for any of those positions, the name would pop up, out would go an application that would say, we have an opening, would you care to apply? Because frankly, you know, if you get down to some of these people on the registers, finally a job comes open for a clerk for a position, you call, those people have been out of state for a year and a half, you know? They're gone, or they've been working someplace else and are too close to retirement now by the time we get there to get them. So, you know, there are some real efficiencies, and Representative Barnes is certainly an area that we're looking at for downsizing and consolidating, providing the service and consolidating. We have also downsized our office in Anchorage, and we'll be transferring those functions down here to Juneau.
Representative Brown.
Thanks. On that subject, after our conversation in the subcommittee, it was brought to my attention that one of the major reasons for having a long register or keeping it is that it does allow you to draw a longer list and hopefully fill positions with women and minorities if they're not fully utilized in that job class. And as far as the suggestion about waiting until there's an opening to invite people to be on the register, we got to be careful not to slow things down to such a grind that the agencies can never hire anyone, because you know it just seems like they'll be passing in the night. Because I think when you know that you have an opening and you're ready to go, you call the register and try to fill it if you can, if it's a critical position. So those are just some additional thoughts on it.
Yeah, but this is, again, we're looking at this as a seed and saying how can we address it. But I think those concerns are real legitimate. And when we get down to that point, we'll chat about how we might factor in those protections.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, and I may have missed something, or something I should know and I don't. Why do we advertise? The Ketchikan paper the other day caught my eye. It was Pioneer's Homes Nurses or something, and it was one of those big long things where they list all, it was, you know, an ad that obviously costs money to do, and a big long list of all the different types of nurses you have at the Pioneer's Home, and then it said, but we don't have any vacancies right now, so, you know, but apply if you're interested. And why do we do that?
I know that from time to time we do open recruitment because we do specialized positions, and maybe, do you know?
One of the things that certainly with the Pioneer Homes and the nurses and nurses' aides, there's a continual need for those types of positions. So I think what we try to do is maintain a list of interested people and then call them on vacancies. A lot of times we're looking at non-perms for filling in on shifts and things like that. And so there really is a critical need for a lot of those types of nurses' aides positions. And I think the same is true with HNSS as far as shortfall of those types of workers around the state.
If I might just follow up then, why say no vacancies?
What you described really does sound.
I would say that those are some that you might need to build a register because you can't go without a nurse, in those homes.
I'm just curious.
So, yeah, I'd be interested in seeing.
What did you say? We have openings that come up all the time in this. I mean, why would someone apply for a job that there's no openings in?
Lots
of people do. And with the nurses' aides class, Representative Bauer, that particular class will actually, you know, go looking for people and say, you know, will you fill out an app? We can get you on a list. I mean, they're that critical at times. And so I would really be interested in seeing this ad, and I'm sure we can respond to it. But just knowing people in my own office, when they're trying to get a list of names for the Pioneer Homes of people at least interested in being nurses' aides, that's not always an easy thing to do. So.
Drives the public sector nuts. I mean, the public sector trains them, and the Pioneer's Home picks them up and pays them
a third more plus benefits. I hear it all the time, and Bert, I think, does too, maybe Nilo as well, from our private nursing home long-term care facility in Fairbanks. They see their folks trained and moved over.
And they're only, nurses' aides are range 9, I believe, for certified, but it's more than you can make in the private
sector. Right, right.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, another thing I'd like to have you look into. In your Pioneer Homes, you presently have more employees than you do patients. You do.
Is that right?
It's a fact.
One per...
It's a 24-hour facility.
You've got more workers than you have people, than customers.
Shifts.
Just like the three shifts.
Well, maybe we could do something really different with some of those shifts. For example, you know, in the last 10 years, I don't think Anchorage has grown that much, but their budget has gone from 5.5 to 9.6 million. So there's got to be some reasons for this, and maybe there's a different way you could work your shift so you didn't have to have more people than you have patients in the nursing home.
API has 298 employees and a census of around 100.
Well, we mentioned going to
those are crazy people, though.
Or 30-hour meetings, right?
Just perspective.
That takes care of
it. Maybe we could...
They're on their own the rest of the
time. Well, just one thing, Mr. Chairman, I know we want to move on. I would be remiss if I didn't take just a second to really thank our subcommittee chairman, you know, Representative Brown, and certainly Kevin Brooks on my staff and the other members of the committee who have really been very open about this process and to talk about alternatives and to come to sort of a meeting of the minds and a common understanding on some of these things. And it has been a very constructive process, and I particularly appreciate this forum. And, you know, we will take these things back and certainly respond to the questions that have come up and crunch these numbers. But I guess the question that begs to be asked is, where do we go from here? How would you like us to proceed to...
Well, what we would like to do is, I think we've written down and have discussed a number of different possibilities, some which require statutory changes, which are options for us to choose between. And I want to try to put a package together of those options that will result in some savings and try to get enough people in the legislature signed onto it that we can actually get them passed through. We'll also, because the statutory changes, the underlying that really drive the budget are the things that if we don't give you those tools, we can't really ask you to reduce your budget. So that's what I think we're trying to do.
Anything at all that we can do to help in this process, we're more than happy to do, you know, whether it's crunching numbers or coming up with demographics or profiles or whatever it happens to be, or running fiscal notes or you know, looking at language or however it works. Anything at all that we can do to support this effort is available to you.
Well, the other thing that I would like to do is when we have our budget closeouts is to make sure that I'm going to try to schedule them so that we have department by department on closeouts, and would like to have you here to discuss when recommendations for reductions are made in certain areas, what those impacts will be on the department, so that we're dealing from these budgets from a perspective of what the responsibilities are and what the requirements are and the statutory obligations are, rather than just in terms of numbers, because I think we need to move away from that. Yeah. Representative Brown.
Thank you. How are we going to handle closeout in relation to the necessary passage of legislation? I mean, are we going to assume that some things are going to pass and therefore we can build the budget on that basis? Or are we, at what point, how far along does legislation need to be before we'll want to build it in as a budget reduction? Because I can see us really getting into a bottleneck with trying to work this out.
I think that while we haven't quite figured out exactly what the plan is going to be, that we have to make some assumptions about the pieces that we feel are going to be part of a package, that we can get enough people on board to assume that those policy changes, statutory changes will be made. If they're not, then we'll have to have a piece of legislation that catches up as a supplement to the operating budget that we pass, which will reflect the inability or unwillingness of the legislature to make the statutory changes necessary to affect those reductions. Off the top of my head.
But I think the answer too is that we try to move everything to the floor at the same time. So if you have a budget predicated on 10 pieces of legislation passing, you move your budget Monday, you move your stack of bills Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and you hold your budget until the bills are all passed. So you get enough folks putting their hands up in the air, because you wouldn't want to let your budget go.
We don't put our hands up, we push your buttons.
Push your buttons. But I think you can't pass the budget that's predicated on things passing without the things going with it to the other body.
Learning as we go.
I have a suggestion.
No, the feeling.
Representative Phillips.
I often felt that the legislature itself can pass the budget document and have it on the governor's desk by the 90th day, and then spend the next 30 days after that, between the 91st and 121st, dealing with substantive legislation. Don't like that, huh?
Well, I don't think we'll have an understanding of the budget within 90 days, much less be ready to close it out and put it on the governor's desk in that period of time. I mean, really, to identify the statutory changes and reach some type of consensus on what those changes are, I think it takes more than 90 days. Maybe if we get this process in place, next year it won't take as long. I think it's going to take a while. But I'm... Is there any further questions, comments, suggestions?
Mr. Chairman, if we keep saying we can't do this, we can't do that, then it won't be done.
Okay, well, let's just take a vote of the committee. How many of the committee members feel we can get the budget out by the 90th day?
We've done it before. We've done it in the 66th day last year.
We didn't pass any legislation.
We didn't pass any reduction.
We didn't have a package.
Running the show.
The budget, though, is what we're doing is the budget is predicated on some statutory changes, I think, this year.
That's right. And that would give us the initiative the last 30 days to pass it if we're really serious about reducing the budget.
Well, my goal is to try to get this budget out as quick as we possibly can, given the job that we're trying to do. I mean, I don't want to delay this. I don't think anybody wants to delay it.
Too many games get played. I mean, it has to go as a package, a whole ball of wax. Because we'd goof around for 30 days being scared to death of doing anything with legislation and pass a budget, and all of a sudden the budget doesn't balance, can't balance, and you have to come back in and supplementally fund it. That's what happens. When we walk out of here and we know the governor's going to veto things, we leave it up to him, and it's her in some future tense, I suppose, and we leave it up to the governor to do that, and we know that we're going to come back in with us this year $140 million worth of supplemental needs or whatever it's going to end up being. So we have to pass it together. We've got to pass the longevity bonus bill. If we're going to do anything, we have to pass that bill, and it ought to go to the floor of the House on the same day the budget does, or in the same week, so that the public makes the connection between a cap on the dividend, the $60 million cap, if that's what you agree to do, and the changes over to this other system. The public won't make the connection if you pass a budget one day and maybe pass something else 28 days later. The public doesn't make the connection, and that's we need the public to play in this game.
Senator Barnes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, good representative from Fairbanks, I think, when he talks about people goofing around, I want him to speak for himself.
I was going to say.
He can goof around all he wants to, but I don't do much of that. And as far as the public, frequently around this year I've heard people say, well, the public don't understand this or the public don't understand that. I think too often we sell the public short. Public does understand. They understand fully well. All they have to do is be told the truth, and they'll understand, and they can grasp it. It's like, the open or closed primary around here for a month. We heard the public doesn't understand an open primary, closed primary. You think Alaskans are more stupid than the people in the Lower 48 who are now going through these closed primaries? I mean, I think we got some of the smartest people in the world in Alaska, and I think that they understand. And I don't think we need to sell them short. I personally believe, though, that we do need to have a total plan, something that everybody can look at, sink their teeth in, and believe in or not believe in, as the case may be. And I don't think it's going to be an easy process. It's going to require a lot of communication. And it's going to require us all reading off the same sheet of music using the same numbers. And eventually I hope we'll all get to the point where we have the same set of numbers.
Representative Barnes, from the same set of numbers, if you're operating off of, for reduction purposes other than the governor's FY93 budget, I'd suggest that you change to whatever the FY93 budget documents are, because that's the documents we have. As far as the reductions that you can make from that and the level of reductions that you would like to make, they're all open for discussion. You can go as deep as you want. If you're talking about the level of revenues that we're going to have available or how much of a revenue shortfall we're going to have, I don't think that anyone sitting at this table, or certainly in the administration or probably in this room and maybe even in this state, nobody believes that the price of oil is going to go up enough to bail us out. We have to make reductions.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond. I am reading off the governor's, and all the papers that we have done have been based on the governor's FY93 budget. When you talk about the governor's FY93 budget, and you talk about the amount of reductions you're going to take in that, and I don't intend to argue this with you in here, you have to all be reading from the same sheet of music. And before we can do that, we all have to agree on a number and we have to nail it down. We've not done that. And beyond that, you have to agree based on a revenue projection from the Department of Revenue what the price of a barrel of oil is. You and I had this discussion the other day. What they're projecting it to be over the FY93 year. And with that and the known revenues that we have, the reserves, we have to decide then what the deficit will be based upon those projections. But we all need to be using the same sheet of projections. And you know, what really irritates me is I've got a sheet before me that says based on a $15 a barrel oil over FY93, I know that we'll have at least a $950 million deficit using the governor's numbers. And $15 a barrel and the number of barrels flowing through the pipeline. But then I read where somebody else says, well, no, we only have a $300 million deficit. Well, I want us to all read off the same sheet of music, and I want us all to sit down and agree what that's going to be at some point in time.
I would very much like that too, Representative Barnes.
Good.
And it won't be your sheet, and it won't be my sheet, okay?
That'll be fine.
So that $15 a barrel scenario is not reasonable. Representative Brown.
Well, I understand the point you're making, Representative Barnes is making. I tend to think it's not worth too much of our emotional energy because here before long, we've almost waited long enough that we're going to finally get the March projections. I think given the urgency of the task and the timeline, it's important to keep the thing moving. We can't wait for this sheet of, you know, everyone to agree on what the mid-case or whatever number we're going to have. We've got to keep moving. Under any scenario, we're going to have to make a big reduction. And I think, you know, you can pick any number you want, but you won't get there just in reductions or even in just reductions in reserves.
I do not disagree, Mr. Chairman, with the fact that we should continue to keep moving. But if we're going to work this thing through in a productive way, we have got to get revenue, legislative finance, or somebody to give us a projected cost of a barrel of oil over FY93 and our projected revenues so that we know what it is that we're shooting for and we can all read off the same sheet of music. That's all I ask for.
Representative Ulmer.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say thanks to Nancy. You were the first one. You took us through it, I think, in a real professional manner. Nobody likes all of the recommendations you've made, but I think some of the recommendations are very viable. And thank you for doing it. I would just ask you to think about your budget in the context of change over time. One of the things we heard from ISER this afternoon was cautioning us not to just budget this year, but budget for what we see the next few years to look like, because there are some quick-term solutions that might exacerbate the situation over the next 3, 4, 5 years. And I just ask you, as you pass through your budget again in terms of looking for potential reductions, that you think about it in the context of which programs have grown rapidly, whatever, you know, longevity bonus or whatever, what those growth projections look like, to think about that as well when you come back to us with any additional proposed changes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, I'd like to thank you also. I think you did a great job. It is what we're trying to do, is understand the underlying policies that drive the budget so we can make some of those policy decisions that none of us think will be popular. And I appreciate your being first, and I appreciate your willingness to be forthright with us.
Thank you very much.
Representative Boyer.
Question of Shelby. Are we going to get something that looks like this from all of the other departments? Only because this is
like
a very,
it?
It's just very easy to slip through, and there are only 16 or 15 other departments or whatever.
It's like everything else you say, we don't have anything uniform. We'll see if we can get the department
to help us out. Okay. Thank you. Without objection, the meeting.
Thank you.